So out of all of the modern scientific discoveries and technological innovations of the past 100 years, there are many that are amazing, incredible, but the one that has moved me the most is the one that first happened successfully in 1954. The ability to transplant a vital organ from one human being, in that case a kidney, from a recently deceased person, into the body of another person whose corresponding organ, in that case a kidney, kidneys, were failing, and who, if she was alive at any other time in human history, would have died. Since 1954, the science has progressed tremendously. We're now able to transplant various organs and even transplant certain organs like kidneys from living donors. Though I've not known anyone close to me who's gone through this experience, I've known people for whom and through whom this has been a reality and has changed their life. In the case of a living donor, say of a kidney, it's often a relative, maybe a sibling, who donates the organ. They literally give a part of themselves to another human being. I guess it's obvious that one of the reasons this might move us as we reflect here in this place today is that I see an analogy. There is a clear analogy, isn't there, to what Christ does for us. He comes to us in our dying state, in our confused and broken state, as a living donor. The bread that I give for the life of the world is my flesh. The bread that I give. Bread, as I said last week, and we've now been multiple weeks in John chapter 6, one of the most important and consequential chapters in the New Testament for Christians. Bread is a metaphor that means something in a culture where many people regularly feel hunger. My father grew up in a place where he was constantly hungry. And when at 13 he first sat down to a meal here in Canada, having newly arrived off the boat, as they say, and he was offered seconds, he didn't know what to say. He literally did not know what to say. But it's hard for us to feel the visceral power of bread as a metaphor in our well-fed state. But then Jesus says that the bread that he's giving is his flesh, his muscle, his blood. And when he does that, things change. I mean, I know it's confusing or mixing metaphors. It's not what any teacher of creative writing would suggest if you were writing something. But it's a deeply shocking change nonetheless. We begin to picture something in our mind's eye that not only would have been abhorrent to kosher Jews. We read in many places, in fact, the first synodical gathering in the book of Acts stipulates that even Gentile Christians should try to avoid blood in the meat, please. Drain it so as not to offend your Jewish compatriots in the faith. But the picture that Jesus is beginning to elicit in our minds would have been abhorrent to most human beings who have ever lived. It's cannibalistic suggestion. Now, I argue, or I would assert, that Jesus has to drive the metaphor in this direction to get across the seriousness of what humanity's rescue is costing God. Paul's famous line in Romans, "While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us," is a neat little packaged sentence. But if you ruminate on it, It speaks of the great cost of this donor act, this transplanting of God's life towards the human race or into the human race. We begin to sense that everything Jesus has been about, his teaching, his parables, his great works of power, well, they're not like, though the crowds wanted them to be like this, they're not like a charcuterie board to be sampled by the lake on a pleasant Sunday. It's actually something very costly that quite literally will cut to the bone. To be on the list, to be an organ donor, that's a strange act, isn't it? Potential donors hope their act of generosity never happens. It's kind of a strange feeling. Though if death comes in some non-diseased way, that the organs will be able to be harvested. One of those horrible words, but there it is. The organs will be able to be harvested so that somehow life might come from death. But God is a living donor, a donor who wants to give of her own heart and place it in us, a donor who wants to donate the divine spirit to us. But make no mistake, that will, in some way that is deeply mysterious, cost God more than we can ask, more than we can imagine. Though the analogy might be new to some of us, I'm betting everything I've said up to this point is familiar to you if you've had a long association with the faith. I mean, we hope it never ceases to amaze us, to bring us to awe and love. But it's generally what we mean when we use the shorthand, the gospel. The gospel. The good news. But the New Testament doesn't end the story of the gospel there, does it? To extend the analogy and to move to our first text, which is a beautiful, if you want to look for a path that outlines what might happen in your Christian existence and life, you could do worse than that first text we read today. But I want to use it now in the analogy I've been developing. Imagine receiving such an incredibly precious gift and then not caring for it. One of the realities of receiving a transplanted organ is that they can be rejected as a foreign body, foreign object by the body's immune system. And so medical science has been working hard to create anti-rejection drugs for such scenarios. And many times they work, but sometimes they don't. But there is sometimes a more tragic reality. The donated organ can be neglected by the recipient and so ruined all over again. I have a relative in law who, as a diabetic, was given a new lease on life in his 40s. He was almost blind by that point, and he received a transplanted pancreas. And then, astoundingly, didn't care for it. Ate wildly, never exercised, and now is bound to a chair, overweight and chronically ill. And so in all of Jesus' teaching, and certainly in the letters like the one to the Ephesians, we see this familiar pattern. God gives. God gives astonishingly. God gives of God's own self. But then, because the goal has always been something like partnership, the goal has always been something like human beings becoming daughters and sons of God, there's this whole subjective existential reality of becoming who God has made us to be. Becoming who God has made us to be. And so God's gifts are always gifts of empowerment. They're gifts of new possibility. They're not one-time experiences, but the gift of a path, the gift of a new orientation that, if followed, will yield a knowledge and a purpose that will change us and those around us. Last week, we talked about learning to speak the truth. Learning to speak the truth. So here it's reiterated. So then, putting away falsehood, let all of us speak the truth to our neighbors, for we are members of one another. And that becomes like a core value in the church, a core value of what it means to nurture the gift. Without it, everything becomes hypocritical. Another way we nurture this amazing gift is by learning to live wisely with our emotions. We're urged to, and now I'm quoting, be angry, but do not sin. In other words, we're not to stuff our anger, but we're not to coddle it. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. We also read an apparent contradiction to put away all bitterness, wrath, anger, wrangling, slander, together with malice. I guess what's going on here is that anger is complicated. Anger can metastasize so easily into bitterness, wrath, slander, wrangling. I love that word, wrangling. And malice. And yet the opposite of love isn't anger or even hate. It's apathy. It's disinterest. God has anger. Anger that the world is not more just. Anger that people ruin creation without a second thought, or ruin the lives around them as if people were playthings. And so amazingly, we're called to be angry in God's way by learning emotional regulation. By counting, as one therapist told me, not to 10, but to 30. In your case, count to 30. When you're feeling reactive, just triple it. And by asking, and I thought this was great, when she said, one of the ways you can get to 30 is by asking this question: what's truly making you angry? Why am I frustrated? Is it something internal? Is it some sense of shame? Is it actually something somebody has done to me? So to nurture this gift of Christ's heart is to learn to live honestly. It's to allow emotions their helpful place, a path upon which we learn to orient our emotions toward what is loving and what is just. But positively, right at the end of this piece, we're called to embrace kindness, tender-heartedness, and an attitude of forgiveness to others that God has towards us. And that, in fact, is our baptismal rite. But unless we live into it, unless we practice kindness and tender-heartedness, it's kind of like winning a lottery ticket that just sits on your counter and you don't cash it in. You've been given a great gift, but you have to do something in order for it to become real. In February 2022, and I've shared around this in other times and places, so forgive me, after Denise's surgery in Germany, after her reconstruction of her back, after several weeks of recuperation, she had one final meeting with a surgeon where he laid out the program for the coming year. After he talked to her about what she was to do, she said back to him, "And after that?" And he just looked at her and smiled. "Then you live your life. Then you live your life." To live with God's heart in us is not our natural condition, as mammals. Though it can be exhilarating, it can at times feel deeply frustrating and disorienting. But there's a great paradox in the gospel. Though this is not our natural condition, as we discover it, as we live into it, as we nurture it, it becomes what we always hoped for. After our first service today, a doctor told me, doctor who was attending told me that they teach you in med school that when you give blood or receive blood, you're giving or receiving an organ transplant. The blood has all the genetic markers and cells of another person. All the genetic markers and cells of another person. And here we receive it. The body and the blood, the substance of God. Amen.